please join us and turn in your gather hymnals to 396. 396, we'll sing "In the Lord I'll Be Ever Thankful."
In the Lord I'll be ever thankful. In the Lord I will rejoice. Look to God, do not be afraid. Lift up your voices, the Lord is near. Lift up your voices, the Lord is near. In the Lord I'll be ever thankful. In the Lord I will rejoice. Look to God, do not be afraid. Lift up your voices, the Lord is near. Lift up your voices, the Lord is near.
Presence of Christ be with you all.
And also with you.
Yesterday, we as a body spoke of our yearning for personal renewal, for a renewal of our congregations, for the church as a whole, and for this earth, suffering together with Christ. So today, we return to the source of renewal for ourselves, for our church, and for the earth. This element, this gift of water, we begin this morning with an affirmation and a return to baptism. So I'd invite you to leave your books behind and as a body for us to come and gather around this pool of water as we sing.
Love is flowing, love is flowing, love is flowing from the fountain of life. Love is flowing, love is flowing, love is flowing from the fountain of life. Everyone, love is flowing, love is flowing, love.
Maker of the moon and the stars, through the night, you sent your spirit again over the face of the deep and gave birth to this new day. We praise you for the goodness of your ever new creation. And we pray that we, along with all the baptized, may live on this ground and in this day, already as your new creation, which you have begun among us. in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, our river of life. Amen.
Turn in your gather hymnals to 343, hymn 343.
Having welcomed a new day and remembering our baptism, we now get even another part of the feast, another thing to enjoy, and that's our speaker for this morning, who is Dorothy Bass. Dorothy, when I think of Dorothy, sometimes I think of an anecdote I've heard people say about Kevin Bacon. Isn't it a game that people play about people who star in movies, and you say, you see how many degrees of separation, right? You know, this person starred with them. And this. There's a similar game you could play with Dorothy Bass. Find renewal in the church in North America and see how many degrees of separation there are from Dorothy Bass. On the way over to pick up Paul Santmeier at the airport, I was telling her about this great book I just heard about singing and the way it relates to our bodies and the earth. And Dorothy very graciously said, "Oh, yeah, I had the privilege of editing that book and writing the foreword. It's coming out this week." Dorothy is greatly respected in the academy, and she hangs out with all kinds of high-powered academic people. And she keeps close contact with this church. and does a great job of quietly and behind the scenes supporting many people in their endeavors, including people like all of us, in working to renew the practices of faith in our parish as a reality on the ground. It's not just something in our heads. We're blessed to have Dorothy here with us for this week, and also she's going to be the teaching staff coordinator for this coming summer here at Holden Village. So she's gathering people using all her degrees of separation to gather in teaching staff from all over the place. Dorothy's thought revolves largely around these areas of Christian practice. She wants to say that the way we do things like eating and singing and paying attention to time matter, and not just that these practices can help us kind of cope with being on the earth, kind of cope with being alive, but that we can do these ways informed by our Christian tradition that can lead us to lives, she uses this phrase, of human flourishing in this, and it has that kind of ecological ring to it. Dorothy's written a wonderful book about the practices of receiving the day and Christian timekeeping practices. She's edited a million things, and she's got her hands in lots of other things. You can read those in her bio, but let's hear what she has to say to us today, and let's welcome Dorothy Bass.
Thank you so much, Ben. You're such a gracious host here. Well, I think that in my talk, I'm going to take us out into the culture a little bit before coming back here to the place of liturgy and then sending us out again into the world. What I'd like to try to do this morning is to offer you a way of thinking about daily life in our culture that does not really begin with the ecological concerns that are at the heart of our conference, but that I think has tremendous implications for them. Okay? And I hope you'll agree at the end. And let's begin in the early 1960s, a time of great infatuation with technology, men in space, right? New conveniences for the home. And about that time in American society, a television in every house, almost, okay, in the 60s. Lots of changes in daily life, and thoughtful people were beginning to realize just how much the revolution in telecommunications was going to impact us and our culture. Some churches rushed to embrace the new technology. This is the heyday of Oral Roberts and Billy Graham. But others were more wary. And at just the same time, and I do not know if there's an intrinsic relation between these two developments, there probably should be, just about the same time liturgical renewal was really taking off in this country, okay, leading up, and in Europe and around the world, leading up to Vatican II, of course, in 1963 to 65. And the renewal of Vatican II in liturgy has been of great importance in shaping all the liturgical worship of this last 40 years or so. Now, in this context, a practical issue arose in the Catholic community. Should the Mass be televised? And Sister Joan, many of my sources, most of my sources in this lecture are Catholic. There's lots of insight here. Should the Mass be televised? Should that tactile, embodied, sacramental act of the assembly be allowed to, I mean, should the church encourage that to be portrayed on a shallow, flat screen for indiscriminate viewing everywhere by isolated people in their homes? That was the question. And Karl Rahner, one of the great Catholic theologians of the mid-20th century, made a visionary remark, which is where I get my title for this talk and which I think has lots of implications for us. Here's what he said. Once television becomes part of the ordinary person's ordinary furniture, once we are accustomed to looking at anything and everything between heaven and earth that strikes the eye of an indiscriminately curious camera, then it is going to be an extraordinarily exciting thing for the person of the 21st century that there do still exist things which cannot be looked at sitting in an armchair and nibbling a sandwich. It is going to be an indescribable blessing to human beings of the coming centuries if there is still a place, the church, in fact, where we can still retain our full human size, our full natural human size, where we do not have to look at ourselves and our bodies as something archaic, a mere leftover in a world of machines with which we surround ourselves and almost try to replace ourselves, where we still have a place that will continue always to heal us of our own insignificance in the midst of technology, which is indeed our task and our destiny, but can avoid being our ruin only to the degree to which we manage to retain in our life a space too, as of old, for what is merely human, what is on a small scale, what is directed bodily. Okay. What Rahner glimpsed, I think, was that new technologies were laying the groundwork for a way of life that is essentially passive and shallow, because it is characterized by consumption rather than by hands-on creativity and participation, a way of life cluttered by so many images that people forget or no longer care about which images are important, a way of life that does not prize embodied face-to-face communities, a way of life that allows human capacities for attention and wonder to wither, a way of life that is abstracted from what is material and earthly and sacramental. Are you with me? Do you hear this way of life that is encroaching upon us? Yeah. In opposition, he suggested, the church's liturgy offers to human beings a quite different way of understanding who we are and how we are to live, as embodied persons in and with the earth, one another, and material things. And this is what he is calling our full natural human size. Now, it's four decades later, and this is the insight I'm going to explore. But of course, in the last 40 years, the really powerful economic and social forces have been hard at work multiplying the effects that Rahner was beginning to glimpse in the 60s. Okay? The human being as consumer, eating alone rather than sharing life at table, taking little notice of the source and taste of daily bread, while being entertained, though often only mildly so, by numerous images that do not ask or require assent or commitment. Now, I don't mean to say that most of our contemporaries fit this type exactly, mostly because the human spirit just yearns for so much more than this. And many families and friendship groups and congregations and other institutions are engaged in resistance to this way of life, sometimes quite purposefully. However, I do think that within a frenzied consumer economy that operates at 24/7 and that prizes the accumulation of multiple goods, of entertainment, and even of experiences, the accumulation of experiences, the shape of daily life in our society is constantly being pressed toward this pattern, a pattern of shallow and fragmentary engagement with images, persons, and the natural world. In this context, I think it is our critical and crucial task to ask, is this how we as human beings are called to take up with the world? What are the implications of this pattern for our relationships with other people and with God and with creation? What does a human way of life that is shallow, episodic, and isolated mean for the rest of creation? And how could learning to resist this way of living in the world be of benefit to the whole world, including creation? Okay, so this morning I want to explore how liturgy forms us for deeper, more focused engagements with the natural world, even while it also forms us for deeper, more focused engagements with God and one another. You can make this case in lots of different ways, but I'm going to approach it, first of all, by exploring the work of a philosopher named Albert Borgmann. You don't have to necessarily remember all of that, but I just want to acknowledge my debt to him. He talks about what he calls the technological shape of everyday living. Borgmann is a philosophy professor at the University of Montana, very significant figure internationally, but he has stayed in Montana because he loves those mountains. And he's a progressive guy. He's a very active Episcopalian who loves liturgy, and I think he probably would even enjoy this conference. But he's a philosopher and doesn't write so much about theology and religion, so he hasn't developed some of these insights himself. This is the basic insight that he would offer. If we want to understand the basic assumptions that drive contemporary life in developed societies, and the kind of life I was just describing, if we want to understand these basic assumptions and their influence on how we understand and experience the world and our place in it, we must recognize how thoroughly technology sets the terms and conditions of everyday existence. Now, people always get nervous when you start to challenge technology, and I'm not going to take it all away from you this morning or anything like that, so relax. But his claim would, now people always say, well, human beings have used technology since the beginning of human development, tools, etc. Those are all true, but he claims that, and I think this is correct, that the quality, character of contemporary theology abstracts us from the natural world much more than previous technologies did. We can discuss this in questions, but this is the point. In order to gain the goods that technology can produce, and these are genuine goods, such as nourishment and heat, okay, we have entered into relationships with one another, nature, and material things that are false. All the while that technology is assisting in the human pursuit of that which is useful, it is also steadily eroding something else that is of immense value. And listen to this. The thick interplay of persons with one another, with nature, and with the resistant world of material things. Now, here's a case that I think makes it pretty clear. There's a good that we need, that human beings do genuinely need, especially those in northern climates, heat. Okay? Now, let's think about what you have to do to get heat from a fireplace and what the implications of that are for your way of life. Fireplace. Okay? Now, fireplace. There it is in the house. If you want to get warm, what do? You go near it. Okay, so the household gathers. Right? It's communal. It's going to be cold if you go up to your own room. Right? So you gather. Maybe tell some stories. Right? Share life in this setting around the fireplace. Communal. Oops, we need to put another log on the fire. Well, you have to kind of understand wood. You know, what makes good fuel, what doesn't. You got to know how to stack it. And over time, the older people in that little household or big household are going to be teaching the younger people how to do this. Right? Going to be passing on skills and knowledge in that way. How to tend it, how to set it up. Now, can they just stay inside that house and be warm? No, they have to go outside and get some wood, right? You have to get out and engage with nature if you're going to have the good of heat. And you can actually see the trees going down, okay, that you're going to burn. Maybe they're old, dead, bad trees. Maybe it's not a bad thing, you know, but they're going down. You can see it. You're going to engage with nature intergenerationally, outdoors, indoors, communally. Patterns, rhythms of life are going to grow up around this fireplace. You know, you're not going to want to get up until whoever's turn it is to turn on the fire, you know, to start, turn on the fireplace. I've been in culture, yeah, you know, to build the fire has been doing that work, right? And when the fire dies down, time for bed. And, you know, the meals are set around this. So a whole communal rhythm of engagement grows up around this fireplace. And what else does it take? I mean, it takes work, right? Lots of foot pounds of labor, lots of cleaning up. It takes a lot of work. It's a what we call a burden to keep this going, even though it does produce the good of heat. And it also allows, a really interesting phrase, manifold engagement with the world. Okay, multi-textured, multi-layered engagement with the world. Okay, lots of burden. So now let's think about the way I heat my house anyway. The thermostat. I mean, I know there's something going on in the basement, but basically all I have to think about is the thermostat, right? It's equally warm in every room in the house. Everybody go off on their own, right? There's not a central place for that in the house. Do I have to have any knowledge? No, only where the thermostat is, right? I don't have to have any knowledge. And I don't have to teach. I mean, only it take me 30 seconds to teach my kids how to operate, how to get heat, right? I could never go outdoors, and I would still always have it, right? No teaching rhythms of life. Nah, no. You know, I mean, you can be on all the time. You can set it to go down. Feel very environmental. You know, you're turning it down 8 degrees at night. Work burden? No. Okay, so we've been disburdened. But the cost is this manifold engagement with the world. Now, does it take work to produce the heat that heats my house? Yeah. Not my work. Do I ever have to think about the people who do that work? No. Does it take knowledge to produce the heat that heats my house? Yeah. But that I don't have to know it, right? Does it have an impact on nature to heat my house? But, hey, I never see that. Okay, so the point is that this technology, and we could do this time after time after time with different kinds of technologies in our households and in our workplaces, we're disburdened. But one step at a time, we're losing this manifold, multi-textured engagement with reality. Okay. Now, one reason that so you see this disburdened but, in a sense, shallow life, the key point here is invisibility. The environmental impact, the natural impact, the labor, the knowledge is invisible. And I can engage at a really shallow level and get the heat, and who cares, right? Whereas the fireplace is different. Now, there are two reasons, actually. This is a kind of the prime example for explaining this way of thinking. First of all, the word hearth is in Latin is focus, focal. Okay, so this brings a focus to a way of life. It's a focal thing. The fireplace is a focal thing. Later on, we can think about what focal things we have in liturgy. Okay, focal thing. But secondly, I like this example because it shows us a pretty complicated critique of technology. Because would it be environmentally better if we all went back to using wood-burning fireplaces? No, we don't want to do that. That's not a good thing. The point here is to understand the invisibility, okay, and the way in which we've abandoned a multi-textured engagement. It's clearly better to adopt the new technology than to continue to heat the home with wood. So technology has many advantages. We don't want to do that. We want to think about the air, the forests, and so on. The point is to render visible the character of the way in which we take up with the world as late modern people. And to notice how the introduction of technology of a certain kind can alter a whole way of life. Indeed, can alter it so smoothly and seamlessly that we don't even notice how life-changing this alteration is. When we can procure heat at the touch of a thermostat, food at the punch of a button, or, say, transportation across 3 states on one tank of gas, you know, while listening to great music the whole time and chatting, right? Disburdened. But the costs are invisible. The costs are invisible. Our service needs are met so invisibly that we begin to live not in the real natural world, or forget that connection, but in a kind of hyper-reality where time and space don't really make that many demands on us. Okay? I know that there's a basic lie in all this, because the impact is being made. One other theologian calls technology a way of so arranging the world that we do not experience it. Okay. Now let's notice some taken for granted assumptions then that many probably many people in our congregations have, that it's tempting for us to have in this kind of world, in this kind of way of life. First, we can and should master time. Okay, doing things in less time is a good thing, right? Efficiency, is really important. This came up several times last night. Many of you making comments, and Paul also noticing how much pressure there is to do worship as fast as possible. Get it done. 59 minutes maybe, but that's it, right? Well, there's a whole, people who live differently with the natural world did not do that, okay? But this gets even deep into our psyches, I think, this way of thinking. Do you ever, not to confess my, it's something that has happened in my household, I know. You turn on the computer and it takes like 8 seconds to come up. And you get really mad. There's this rage always waiting to erupt from us. I don't think this is how we're supposed to live. With this rage constantly right there or the light doesn't turn green fast enough, or the car in front of us is going too slowly, or maybe to save gas even, but that, it doesn't matter. We just got this rage that's always there because we've been schooled. In this idea, we've been formed without even anybody saying it, that doing things fast is right. And it gets into our spirits. It's in there. And it's the same kind of rage that probably somebody feels when, in our tradition, it's when there's announcement after the last hymn. One more thing. We wanted to make sure. Sit down. The youth group is going to. So, and this rage is just like that computer rage, okay? Second assumption that gets built in is that, Luther just came to mind, I had never made that connection before, the mundane activities of life are tedious and in a sense beneath us. I think how hard Luther worked to overcome that assumption. The milkmaid, the person who sweeps. The mundane acts of life should be eliminated and done by technology if at all possible. Okay. I wonder at Holden if there were something where everybody could just stick their dishes into some contraption that would sit there and wouldn't have to have dish team. It just would like perfectly wash them. Would we want to buy it? Some would and some wouldn't. But there's a question. What would we lose? What would be lost? And, of course, those of us who only come for 3 weeks a year probably would say, oh, no, we want to do dish team. The ones who were here all year long would say, yes, buy it. But it's choices like that keep us engaged with one another and aware of the work of the world. Okay. The American people are eating 40%. It's probably higher now. Last I heard, it was 40% of the food dollars are spent for meals outside, eaten outside the home. Yeah. Okay. Number three, it's a third kind of taken for granted assumption that gets built in here. The human destiny, it's kind of like the previous one, I guess. The human destiny is to eliminate burdens and friction. You know, the more advanced we get, the more evolved, the less we'll have to be burdened and weighed down by these concerns for material things. There's even a, you know, it'll all be taken care of. And you can see this in, you know, even a cartoon about the space age. Just walk into a room and, well, Bill Gates' house. You know, you walk into a room, you don't even have to turn on the stereo. It just knows from the chip which music you're going to want. Right? You've heard this? So, anyway. Now, it's not quite clear what the leisure that all this is supposed to create is for. Okay? Because then that becomes also an arena of consumption and speed and rage and so on. Okay? Even, you know, and heat's a great example, but even my own line of work, that I look a lot of things up on the internet for information when I'm writing or I need something to put in. But it really is a different and better thing to go over to the library and to look at what's on the shelf and to browse through an actual book and to find something you weren't looking for. And to have a conversation with somebody who's also looking at the theology of creation shelf, you know? Or to go to the bookstore and to engage people, the librarian, the bookseller, right? I mean, it's a different kind of experience. So, and the fourth kind of taken for granted assumption, this one is hard, and maybe it doesn't affect you, people who would come to this conference as much as others, but it affects many, many young people especially, and that's this infatuation with hyperreality, with the brilliance of the screen, the speed and, you know, the speed of the computer game, right? The infatuation with the simulated. And I think related to this is the idea that you learn about nature by going to Disney's Fort Wilderness. Okay. Now, many people today would say, if you can get the product without the burdensome process, why not? Okay, why not simply take advantage of all the more convenient ways of having the things that we enjoy? It's an important question. And there are many kinds of disburdenment that I do not myself plan to abandon. You could say that for millennia, human beings were deeply engaged with nature, simply gathering food. Okay, there's deep engagement. It's communal. It's multi-textured. You go, but you know, we do have a vision of being able to do more than that, and I think that's not a bad thing. But as environmentalists and as Christians, there are many reasons to be wary of convenience in this way. Now, obviously, one of them is, which with immense environmental significance, is that we're hoping, as environmentalists, that the people of North America, let's say, will be willing to take on some burdens for the sake of the health of creation and to ride public transportation rather than to use private cars, right? To compost rather than landfill, okay? And there are some burdens here. There is some real time and real engagement with the mundane world that we're hoping they'll be willing to take on. The main reason people give for not being willing to do such things is that it's not convenient, I don't have time. But there's also immense spiritual and theological significance in this idea of deeper engagement with the world of material things. When we pursue the goods we think we need or think we need as commodities that can and should be harvested with as little burden as possible, we enter a way of life that robs us of knowledge of our true human condition. Some truths. Now, I'll get to liturgy in a minute, but I think all of these are also in liturgy. Some truths. We do live in time. We are mortal. We are finite. And there it is. There's a denial of that implied in some of these other ways of approaching the world. Secondly, it is often in embracing these limits, in making a commitment to one person rather than leaving it wide open, you know, or in being with the dying, acknowledging that that one will die, that we have our deepest experiences, in a sense. We become most fully who we are in relationship to, as we embrace those limits. The limit of you know, getting tied down by caring for a child, or making a commitment to a group of people in some way. Okay? Another truth about ourselves that is denied by this way of life: we need one another. Okay? The burdens of engagement are also the places of blessing. It's where we meet those we love, where we become who we are. Another truth: we are part of creation and subject to its reality, open to the wonder of sharing in it. Time and space are real in this. Someone has said that it's in the wilderness, when you're going to hike up into the wilderness, that actually time and space have some real meaning compared to when you're out on the freeway. Okay? I mean, it does actually take a certain amount of time, real time, to walk to Heart Lake. You know, and if something bad happens to you while you're there, it takes a while to get out. Right? It's real. It's engaged, and we are part of creation. We forget that as we kind of float along on its surface. In the back home, someone has pointed out to me that being driven and being driven may not be that different. Okay. As a state of mind and as always being in cars. Okay, and our Earth Ministry, I think, has a car-free Sunday program urging people to leave their cars at home for a Sunday. Is it once a month or certain days you announce? Yeah. And that makes some sense, though, of course, the way we live makes that difficult. But one more truth, one more reason for being suspect of this disengaged way of being with the material, natural world is, of course, the incarnation itself, that God has embraced the mundane, even the burdensome, in the incarnation of Jesus Christ. And here it's like Paul Sandmeyer's turning the Gothic upside down, that God has come down and really dwells and is saying to us, this place is holy, this natural world. I want to kind of summarize the falsehoods of this late modern way of life and to point towards what Christian faith can offer in challenge to it. I want to quote one paragraph from this book, which has really informed what I'm telling you in this lecture, by a Catholic theologian named Richard Ghilardi. We're going to give you a bibliography at the end of the conference of the books that we've all mentioned in our talks, so you can get that then, called Transforming Our Days: Spirituality, Community, and Liturgy in a Technological Culture. Let me just read this one few sentences. He speaks of the basic Christian conviction that grace, blessing, and the possibility of salvation do not come to us in the progressive manipulation of time and maximization of consumption that technology offers. Rather, they come to us in the conscious attentiveness to the signals of the divine that glimmer in basic human engagements, and in the free acceptance of the constraints of time and the burdens of human commitment. The true blessings of life can never be simply ready at hand, ready-made. Rather, they surprise us in the midst of daily living. This, then, is the central wisdom of Christianity that needs to be brought to our technological, consumer-driven world. We find human fulfillment precisely when we cease making fulfillment the immediate end of all our actions and instead give ourselves over freely to lives of committed service and love. Now, once again, Borgma and Ghilardi, I all agree that there are many benefits in modern technology, and we are grateful for them. I have no plans to renounce many of them. But rather, the program that is being encouraged here is to deliberately choose and find some focal practices which you and your community commit to. Keeping some way, finding ways, certain practices that you see are ways to retain the knowledge of who we really are. For example, and this is one that I think a lot of people are involved in, to make our life with food a matter of real engagement, multi-layered engagement with God, with one another, and with creation. Many of us are trying to become much more conscious of where our food comes from, to open the curtains that cloak the invisibility of those who produce it, okay? To do our best to support them appropriately, to be aware of its impact on the natural world as well, okay? To try to bring our relationship to food kind of into a more natural human size. I belong to a community-supported agriculture group, and in our little town, for example, many people are getting to know their local farmers and helping farmers to survive by being in relationship with them and agreeing in advance to take a portion of their crop. But also around the table in a household, many of the multi-textured relationships that I described with regard to the fireplace are also true. The older ones, the ones who know how to cook, have an interest in teaching those who don't know how to cook, right? And there's a gathering at a table rather than isolated snacking. There's a textured, it takes time. But we accept that burden because we're aware of the grace and joy that's going to come at the table. Maybe not every day, but a lot of the time. Okay, so a way of life that's a little different, that resists this technological culture's way of life, can come into focus around a household's table. In a sense, part of this is has to do with really embodying in the way we live a respect for matter, which, you know, Paul Sattmeyer showed at the bottom of the great chain of being. Wendell Berry says somewhere, you know, the use that we make of matter, of the things of the natural world, tells us what we think of the natural world. It says something about who we are. So to dig into, to put a foothold into nature, to resist the shallow, disengaged way of life that technological culture embodies by our table practices in our households, I think is one way to strive for deep engagement. It's just plain to remember who we are. But as Christians and as liturgists and as environmentalists, we also want to look beyond that family table, the household table, the friendship group, and think about the table of the people of God, the table of the whole world, the table of creation, where, as we heard last night, Luther imagined Adam and Eve and the animals eating together. And here, liturgy, I think, does show the way towards that, but also sends us back into our daily lives in a different way. Liturgy, I would argue, is the paradigmatic focal practice of the Christian community, okay, of the Christian life. Let me unpack that. First of all, liturgy is itself a focal practice, okay, in the same way that I was describing the table and the fireplace. In that, it is communal. People come together, assemble. We come embodied, face to face, hand to hand, not left off in our isolated rooms. We come embodied. the life of liturgy draws us into a rhythm, gives us time in a different kind of way, so that we're not doing 24/7 here, you know, liturgy. It is, Christmas comes, you know, and the cycles go through. There's a certain demand, reality, resistance to 24/7 built into the rhythms of the liturgy. There's lots of room for intergenerational teaching, skills that are passed down. Children learn to participate. Newcomers learn to participate. There's multifold engagement with one another in liturgy, and many opportunities for deep, multi-layered engagement with things and with others. Live music, something that very rarely happens any longer in our society, especially in a non-consumerist way. Okay? Live music, using our bodies to make music, not just the technology of music. The craft of things, banners and beautiful carved objects and things that show regard for the stuff of the material world. And liturgy, I would argue, that does all of these things with intention and seriousness and respect, is in itself, we haven't even gotten to the content yet, but is in itself resistance to that consumer culture of 24/7 commodification. Okay, just see what I mean? Okay, secondly, Christian liturgy, in its specific content, helps us to see who we really are and creation as it really is, and therefore to adopt a more free stance within it that allows for deeper engagement. Okay. Liturgy allows us to see our world as it really is. Now, we had the cosmic walk last night, and Paul talked about the whole gospel for the whole world. And I know Ben's going to do this in some succeeding talks, so I won't go into this in depth. But think of all the ways that this conference is claiming that liturgy helps us to see the cosmic whole of which we are part and places us rightly within that. Okay? So it helps us to see ourselves in that way. It also helps us to see ourselves as we really are, as sinners. Okay? You come in and are reminded, which the consumer culture tries to avoid. Right? First thing, you know, we confess that we have sinned. And that is, we should include environmental sin in that confession. We have. And in that, I'm just so aware that so many conversations about really changing how we live revolve around, are you trying to make me feel guilty? You know, are you blaming me? Okay, we need to have that question of sin on the table, as it were, as we try to talk with our communities about changing our ways environmentally, so that liturgy opens that up for us by telling the truth about who we all are, you know, whether we drive a Prius or an SUV. Liturgy also tells the truth about us in telling us that we are forgiven and therefore free. In baptism, we have died the only death that matters, and therefore we are free to risk, to serve St. Francis. And that, I think, we need that if we're going to be able to take the risks that will be involved in really changing our lives. Okay. And fourth, it's hard to read here, as we really are, not masters of things, okay? Not masters, really, of time and space, even though the technological culture tries to tell us that we were, but rather recipients of gift, No matter what age, our baptism, in a sense, cradled in God's arms. That's another truth about ourselves, that we are recipients, not masters, that liturgy consistently tells. A theologian, Miroslav Volf, probably you'd put him in the Reformed tradition, colleague of mine, says the gospel can be spoken thus. It's the summary of the gospel. Receive yourself and your world as new creation. Receive yourself and your world as new creation. It's very similar to the Lutheran idea that when we know that we are forgiven, we will therefore be free to live in new ways, but it includes the whole of creation in that. So I like all of parts of that. Receive yourself and your world, all as one, and as new creation. And finally, liturgy also is the paradigmatic focal practice of the Christian life, in that through participation in liturgy, our eyes are opened to see God's presence in the practices of everyday life. So back to that table in our households around which I'm hoping we could gather and renew a sense of really daily connection to the earth that's lived out and that forms us against this idea that something has to be fast to be good. Okay? A way of living that out. Eucharist can and should and does show us the way to those meals as well. Gagliardi, the theologian I mentioned, points out that in liturgy, our culture's pattern of binging and dieting is transformed into God's pattern of feasting and fasting. Okay, there's a difference between, it's hard even to feast anymore, isn't it? There's so much food around in the culture that, what is a feast? Mm-hmm. But the church knows what a feast is when we remember ourselves, when we remember and do it right, and fast. Okay. So in the liturgy, we are reminded that the meal we celebrate has its roots in the earth and in the larger world of human relationships. Before we come to the table, we confess our sins and offer Christ's peace to one another. We pray for one another and offer alms for the poor. Throughout the liturgy, we recall our connections with those who are not physically gathered around the table, the communion of saints, the universal church, all people of goodwill. The Eucharist is less about consuming food than about sharing a meal, but a real physical meal, a real physical meal. The food to be shared at this meal is not a mere commodity. We remember that the bread we break is that which earth has given and human hands have made, and the wine we share is the fruit of the vine and the work of human hands. We need to take that consciousness out with us into our other meals. One more quotation, this one from Father Robert Hovde, a Catholic liturgical theologian. Where else in our society are food and drink broken and poured out so that everybody shares and shares alike and all are thereby divinized alike? Where else do economic czars and beggars get the same amount and the same treatment? Where else are we all sprinkled and bowed to and incensed and touched and kissed and treated like somebody, all in the same way? This is playing the reign of God. This is an alternative in contradiction and sharp distinction to our status quo. This classless society is the way things ought to be. My argument would be then that participation in liturgy does ground us in a different kind of relationship to the earth and to one another, and that this is a grounding which we can also bring to these same practices of life at table and other practices as well in everyday life. Paul mentioned last night his encounter with a child from a different cultural group during liturgy. We're invited into liturgy and given the gift of transformative fleshly encounters of that kind, and then are sent out to see the world and live in the world differently. Similarly, I think we eat at that table and we are sent out to eat in a different kind of way. Thank you.
Sing Love is Flowing from the Fountain of Life. Love is